This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work, Policy, and Practice at the University of Chicago, where research meets real-world impact. The master's program in social work, social policy, and social administration blends classroom learning with extensive field education, guided by faculty known for groundbreaking research. Applications are open at crownschool.uchicago.edu/social work. Inspire change. Shape the future. This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Division of the Arts and Humanities at the University of Chicago, offering an interdisciplinary Master of Arts program in humanities that provides individualized attention in a supporting community. The flexible curriculum allows students to focus coursework within a single department or engage with multiple disciplines, creating a uniquely tailored graduate degree. Applications now open for the April 30th deadline at humanities.uchicago.edu.
The list of towns vying to become the new home of the Chicago Bears is growing. Portage, Indiana has unveiled a $5 billion privately financed lakefront stadium proposal.
A new state law preventing banks and credit card companies from charging swipe fees on taxes and tips.
Amazon drone delivery is coming to the Chicago area as soon as this summer.
Illinois Attorney General is suing to block the Trump administration from cutting public health funding in Illinois and three other democratically led states.
Hey, Chicago, I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. It's Friday, so it's time to look back and break down the big stories of the week in our weekly news recap. After signing an executive order to prosecute federal agents for aggressive immigration enforcement, Mayor Johnson dealt with the blowback from the Cook County State's Attorney's Office. Drone delivery of Amazon packages will soon be an option for residents in some South Chicago suburbs. Plus, Portage, Indiana has entered the chat. They want in on the competitive bid for a new Bears stadium.
Congress continues to debate how to fund the Department of Homeland Security. Lawmakers face a Friday deadline or they risk a government shutdown.
A week after Mayor Brandon Johnson's ICE on notice executive order, Cook County's top prosecutors say it may actually backfire.
This was a directive to my police department. It had nothing to do with the state's attorney.
New evidence has been released in the recent shooting of a Chicago woman by a U.S. Border Patrol agent.
We'll get into those stories and much more, but let's start today's episode with a closer look at what's been happening at Chicago's federal courthouse. And who better to check in with than Chicago Sun-Times federal courts reporter John Seidel. He's one of our panelists this week. Hey, John. Good to see you.
Hey, Sasha. Good to see you.
So you give us an update on the case of Miramar Martinez, who was shot five times by federal agents, and Juan Espinoza Martinez, who was acquitted of putting a hit on Greg Bovino. But there are many more people who have been charged, John. So what's the latest?
Yeah. So we've felt it was important to keep track of all of these cases. We have found 32 known defendants. This is from scouring the docket at the federal courthouse. And of those 32 known defendants, we've already seen 16 of them cleared. So Imagine this universe of defendants never expands. Prosecutors are looking at best at a 50% conviction rate if they just like run the table from here on out.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, the news continues on this. We recently had one case. There was a defendant named Eric Meyer who recently saw his case dropped. He was actually looking at trial, I believe, in March, but now his case is going away. We also had the first of what's known as a deferred prosecution agreement. This is basically a deal between, I believe it was Jamie Hernandez and the U.S. Attorney's Office, wherein if Jamie Hernandez abides by certain conditions for a period of 6 months, then his case will go away too. So he's not quite in the clear yet, but it looks like he likely will be. So that would be 17. So that brings him under 50%.
Wow.
Again, yeah. If they were on the table.
And you keeping track of this? My goodness. I understand, though, that there's still one pretty major case that's left here, right?
Yeah, the one that's most high profile that remains is this so-called Broadview 6 case. This is the case of six protesters. Four of them are Democratic politicians who have been accused of a conspiracy to impede a federal officer during protests outside the ICE Broadview facility, you know, the site of so many protests last fall. And one of the defendants, of course, is congressional candidate Kat Abu-Ghazaleh. There are others involved in the case as well. Brian Straw, who I believe is an Oak Park Village trustee, Kat Sharp, she was running for Cook County Board. She actually decided to suspend her campaign to focus on her legal defense. So that case is actually set for trial in late May. It seems like that one's going forward, and you know that's probably going to be the biggest one that remains.
Yeah, so much to dive into. So why don't we just get into the recap? Thank you, John, for stopping by.
Sure, glad to do it.
Also at the table to help make sense of the week's news was Heather Sharon, Chicago politics reporter for WTTW, and Hannah Meisel, state government and politics reporter for Capital News Illinois. Now, new evidence was released in the case of Miramar Martinez, so our guy John kicked things off with the details.
Well, we found out a lot. There was a big batch of evidence from her prosecution last fall. She had been prosecuted, but they dropped the case in November, and all this evidence came out this week. And I think I'd point to three main things.
Okay.
I think that the top headline has to do with this body cam footage that came out. There's no known footage of Miramar's shooting by this Border Patrol agent named Charles Exum. What we got is body cam footage of an agent who sat in the back of the Tahoe that collided with Martinez's car back in October.
Okay.
And I think it's important to remember that when this first happened, Homeland Security came out with a press release and announced that two domestic terrorists, Miramar Martinez and another man, had rammed this Tahoe that Exum had been driving. What we see in the body cam video, though we don't see the shooting, is we see Exum turn his steering wheel to the left, and that's toward Martinez's car. She has always said, and she told us very recently, that he swerved toward her. She mm-hmm. never entered his lane. And that was before this footage came out. And now we see that steering wheel turn to the left.
Mm.
And we also know that Exum got out of the car and then opened fire after agents in the car were also saying, you know, it's time to get aggressive, you know, and
wow.
we're going to make contact. So I think that was important. Also important is a series of text messages and emails that we saw, mostly from Exum, but also, you know, Border Patrol Commander Greg Bovino apparently sent Exum an email just hours after the shooting, praising him and talking about how he wanted to extend Exum's retirement age because he had a lot more great work to do in Chicago.
Interesting.
There were other agents who were texting him and saying, "You're a legend among agents. Beer's on us next time we see you at
just
training."
Celebrating what happened. And we learned as well that this agent who shot Martinez was just placed on administrative leave.
Well, that's what we're told. And so that's kind of remarkable. So after we see all this praise, we see these text messages in response to an inquiry that we made to Homeland Security and Border. It was actually Customs and Border Protection that released this statement. All of a sudden now they did say he was placed on administrative leave. There's obvious follow-up questions to that, which they have not answered.
Right.
When was he placed on administrative leave? Is he still on administrative leave? Is it paid or unpaid? We have reached out. We have not heard anything back. They're actually referring questions now to the Department of Justice, which is also not commenting.
Mm, interesting. Hannah and Heather, your thoughts here on just how damning this new evidence is for DHS.
So I was working the day that this incident occurred, and initially the statement from Homeland Security did not make any sense. They misidentified where this incident occurred. They also, you know, said that Miramar Martinez had been part of a 10-car caravan that was, you know, attempting to harm these agents. That was, as we know now, false. And, you know, they also said in that initial statement that Miramar Martinez had a gun and had sort of threatened the agents in some way. We know that was false too. She was armed legally. She had a FOID card. Her gun was in her purse and snapped into a holster. And actually, some of the documents that were released this week showed that gun sort of properly stowed.
Mm.
And you know, I think it is a little bit startling to see this as one of several cases where what we have heard from federal officials, again, paid by taxpayers, repeatedly sharing false information that over the weeks has sort of come to be mm-hmm. shown to be entirely false. And I think that has made sort of covering these cases as journalists very difficult. And I think it has really made it almost impossible to trust what comes out of the federal government.
This was also, if you remember, October 3rd, that weekend that the Trump administration made, I guess, good on their threats that had been coming for weeks, possibly months, to send in the National Guard. And I think it was that Sunday night that, you know, it was confirmed that they were going to. And this was one of, you know, several incidents that they pointed to and said, oh, look at the violent response in Chicago to Operation Midway Blitz. This is why we need, you know, law enforcement. This is why we need the National Guard to, you know, protect our ICE and Border Patrol officers. You know, the other thing I think is going to be interesting about the civil case that Miramar Martinez and her attorneys are filing against the federal government is that one of the things that will likely come out in litigation is this internal policy that DHS has on what happens when there is a shooting of, you know, someone who, a shooting in general. I guess we don't even know what the policy says because such a limited universe of people know it. Prior to this, only the folks around Miramar Martinez and her, you know, court case that John mentioned earlier, her prosecution that was ultimately dropped, knew it, and DHS. But this was, it's really striking in the in light of the shootings of Renee Good and Alex Pretty in Minneapolis that this shooting seems so similar, but it was really, I feel like, only local news in the fall when it happened. And this, I think, will then shed light on those two cases when the policy is able to be seen by a much more wide universe of people.
Yeah. Well, as you mentioned, federal prosecutors originally charged Martinez with assault. The charges were dropped. The federal government is still painting Martinez as a threat. I want to play a little bit from Chris Parente, who's her attorney. He was on WBEZ's Say More yesterday.
People need to see that they have to accept that they can no longer trust their government because they continue to call this woman a domestic terrorist. They continue to stand by their statements that they were boxed in when there's objective video evidence that shows it simply doesn't exist. Agents start lying and drawing that stuff in. They're doing it because they know that they have a bad shooting and they had to try to justify it.
And as you mentioned, John, you recently sat down with Martinez for an in-depth interview. How is she feeling about all this and how she's being treated by the government?
You know, I think it's difficult for anyone, including her, to understand that. I mean, she was shot by a government agent, and then when she lived, they charged her with assault only to drop the charges. And now they won't back off on this claim about domestic terrorism. I checked the press release, the Homeland Security website, again this morning. It's still up there. So she actually told members of Congress recently she just wants an apology, and she wants the government to acknowledge that she's not a domestic terrorist. I think it's also, you know, Hannah mentioned Renee Good and Alex Pretty. You know, Martinez didn't begin to speak up again until after the death of Alex Pretty. Mm-hmm. In fact, this effort to release the evidence started 2 days after Alex Pretty's death.
Right.
What she told us is that she realizes that she has an opportunity here that they don't have because she lived. And so she believes that she is here to be a voice.
That's her
for
role moving
exactly.
forward. Yeah. I want to stick with immigration, folks, because it's a topic that's got a lot going on right now. Mayor Johnson recently issued an executive order intended to lay the groundwork for prosecuting ICE agents for abuse and misconduct. He talked about that when I interviewed him Wednesday for our monthly Ask the Mayor segment.
Tom Homan came to Chicago last year around this time and said he had to leave because Chicagoans were too educated. Now, I don't know if there's such a thing of being too educated as it relates to the Constitution. It's why I put forth this executive order, not just for ICE-free zones, but to ensure that there's a pathway to accountability to hold these individuals responsible for the cause of crime and harm that they've created.
And so we're clear, Heather, what exactly does the executive order say?
Well, in most cases, state and local law enforcement officials do not have the authority to investigate criminal wrongdoing or misconduct by federal agents who are conducting their normal course of business duties and that they are acting reasonably. What this executive order does is essentially tell the Chicago Police Department, do not grant federal officials that presumption of reasonableness. If you see something, document what happened, preserve that chain of evidence and try to identify the agents responsible for it and their supervisors. Mm-hmm. And this is in response to the shooting of Miramar Martinez and, of course, the death of in Franklin Park, Silverio Villegas. And the problem is that it brought just an intense reaction from Cook County State's Attorney Eileen O'Neill Burke, who called it wholly inappropriate.
Yes.
But the issue is that everybody's sort of between in a rock and a hard place, right? The deaths of Alex Preti and Renee Good really changed the calculus of what I think the wider public expects local law enforcement to do in response to these incidents.
Yeah, well, let me ask you this. As you mentioned, she called it wholly inappropriate. When I talked to the mayor this week, he said, quote, "People around the country are using my executive orders as models to implement protection for their residents." Do Eileen O'Neill Burke's comments bring into question what kind of working relationship they have?
Well,
they don't seem to be on the same page about
this. They are not, and they've never been. They're on opposite sides of the sort of Chicago Democratic Party. Eileen O'Neill Burke was elected sort of with the support of the Fraternal Order of Police, who, you know, vociferously opposed Mayor Johnson's election. The issue is sort of one sentence in this executive order, which instructs CPD to forward that evidence to the state's attorney at the direction of the mayor's office. Now, the state's attorney's office says that is inappropriate sort of intervention in a law enforcement investigation by political officials. Johnson says, essentially, you misread my executive order. I am only directing the Chicago Police Department, who, I remind you, reports to me.
Right.
And so what we're waiting for now is the rules that will instruct the officers and supervisors on how to implement this executive order. And the mayor has said, you know, let's wait for that. And then we can sort of figure out where we're going to go. But the pressure on Eileen O'Neill Burke to do something differently than she did in the wake of the shooting of Miramar Martinez and the other shooting in Franklin Park is going to be intense. Now, her office will say, look, I don't have investigators. I'm not an investigating agency. My job is to review evidence gathered by police departments and then make a decision on whether to charge anybody. She says there's a new protocol that she's developed. Nobody outside her office or other law enforcement agencies have seen that protocol. So there's a lot we don't know about what is changing.
On the note of the pressure, yesterday, Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle jumped into the conversation, right? Along with half the county's commissioners, they're also calling on the state's attorney to file charges, specifically in cases where the feds shoot people. What do you make of that development, John?
You know, I've just been watching this increased pressure on Eileen O'Neill Burke, and I think it just continued with that statement yesterday. And I don't think it's going away. And it's interesting, Heather mentioned the kind of the prosecutor, the state's attorney, being on an opposite end of the political spectrum from a lot of our leaders here in Chicago. And we're seeing that play out. I will say, you know, I asked back to Miramar Martinez, her attorney had a press conference this week to talk about the evidence. I asked him about whether or not he's reached out to Eileen O'Neill Burke. For his part, I mean, there does seem to be some kind of federal investigation still revolving around the Miramar Martinez shooting. Parente, the attorney, says that the U.S. Attorney's Office in South Bend is investigating Exum's conduct. So far, the government has just acknowledged an ongoing criminal investigation, but hasn't gone beyond that. Parente says he's hopeful. You know, Parente's a former federal prosecutor himself. You know, and so what his response was that he hopes that that the FBI and the federal government, there is still some sliver of what he knew when he worked for the feds, and that the FBI will do its job and be the one to file charges here.
Right.
Yeah. I do wonder, I mean, the Cook County State's Attorney is one avenue to charge, but I do wonder if down the line the State's Attorney General got, I guess, you know, they have capacity issues in that office for sure. But if it got to the point where, you know, the state has this commission that the governor, you know, put together in October to investigate abuses of these federal immigration agents. They've had one initial report so far. They've got ongoing meetings and, you know, more reports to come. And I do wonder that if the attorney general jumped into the fray and started, you know, using some resources to prosecute if that would put pressure on the Cook County
State
Attorney.
Might they have a role here as well? Now, the latest from Burke, she tells the Sun-Times her team has drafted a protocol for how local legal systems can address misconduct by federal agents that's, quote, clear and grounded in law. And she goes on to say, quote, we're committed to doing all that we can under the law to support and review law enforcement investigations of that conduct and prosecute when appropriate. Let's move on here, Heather. Chicago Police Superintendent Larry Snelling also been urged to take steps to make sure police officers aren't helping these federal agents. What's being asked of him and how's he responding?
Well, on Wednesday, the Chicago City Council will vote on whether to give the Civilian Office of Police Accountability the authority to investigate allegations that Chicago Police Department officers have violated the city's welcoming city ordinance. Now, that ordinance is the law that prevents any city employee from helping federal agents enforce federal civil immigration law. There was a loophole discovered sort of after the Trump administration sort of started these more aggressive immigration raids, that essentially it's not clear in the city's code who investigates those allegations. Mm-hmm. And so the city council, the Chicago, the city's police oversight board has been trying to sort of figure out which agency should do that work. And there seems to be wide consensus that that should go to the city's outside police misconduct agency. But of course, that is subject to Wednesday's city council vote. Now, Superintendent Snelling has said that he backs that measure. Okay. And at the January meeting of the Chicago Police Oversight Board, said essentially he backed it because he said explicitly there's always issues of trust involving the Chicago Police Department, and that he did not believe that investigations conducted by internals and affairs investigators would be considered fair by the public, which I thought was an interesting admission by the city's top cop.
Yeah. Well, yesterday, Border Czar Tom Homan announced that ICE enforcement in Minnesota is winding down, Hannah. Might this be tied to the funding crisis that's looming for DHS?
I mean, I do think that when you set up an expectation of funding that has basically changed the funding of DHS from, I think, $9 billion in just a couple years ago to $900 now, then not having the access to that when you have been actively recruiting ICE and Border Patrol agents for months and months and months, giving them supposed $50,000 bonuses, although you apparently don't get that unless you're there for 5 years. I could see it tied to that. I could also see tied to the pressure that's been put on the Trump administration in the wake of the fatal shootings of Renee Good and Alex Pretty.
And Congress is seeming really at odds here about to actually potentially reform this agency.
Exactly. And I don't think that anyone's going to be holding their breath for Congress to do anything. I think that's an evergreen statement for the last 15 years and probably going forward. But, I also want to remind listeners that back in the fall, when Operation Midway Blitz was winding down, the Chicago Sun-Times reported that they were going to be probably back in early March. Mm-hmm. And early March is really coming up here.
Yeah. Well, and they came back.
They did come
after
back
that.
Briefly.
They've already done a comeback
before Christmas. But
We're looking ahead to next month because something's around the corner. Conversation over to City Hall, where a group of aldermen have formed something called the Budget Accountability Coalition. What is this about, Heather?
Well, this is the aftermath of the really fraught and intense and at times deeply personal debate over the city's 2026 budget, which, of course, if you remember, went into effect over Brandon Johnson, the mayor's objections. And this is the group of alder people that really led that effort to change the budget by removing the head tax to reduce what Johnson said was necessary to tax large firms to help the city's budget crisis. And they are convinced that on several different fronts that the mayor is not implementing that budget as he should. And this commission is their attempt to sort of formalize their attempt to sort of hold the mayor's feet to the fire on this.
This is, I mean, what are the odds here that, like, you can do this? Like, you know, being a mayor, I guess, what does that mean here in the city of Chicago? Just the entire strong mayor, weak mayor conversation sort of comes to mind.
Well,
all over again.
The first thing they did was to haul the city's top financial officials in front of the city's finance committee to demand to know why the city had not made sort of the full advanced pension payment. Mm-hmm. So the city pays by law more than $2.5 billion into its four pension funds. But the city council, part of the changes they made, said, no, we got to pay more. We got to pay more than the minimum payment on this credit card and try to reduce this debt to total $260 million. But in January, the mayor's office only made $130 million in payment. And there were many alder people who suggested that the mayor was thwarting the will of the council. And what happened when Budget Director Annette Guzman and other officials came before the finance committee, they said, look, we're happy to make this payment. The city is broke.
Yeah.
We do not have that money. If we had that money, we'd been happy to do it, but we don't. And what's interesting, I thought, was that a lot of the, you know, sort of very vocal critics of the mayor appeared to accept that. They said, okay, this is, you've sort of shown us the details. The question is sort of, does that sort of acceptance of what the mayor's office says are the facts, does that continue, or are we back where we were in November and December, where everybody cannot agree on what the facts are, which makes it impossible to reach solution?
Yeah, we're so far apart. Well, we've invited some of the aldermen involved in this to join us on In the Loop next week, so I'm dying to have a conversation with them to learn more. Now, Johnson's original budget did include a $2 tax on intoxicating hemp products. That was projected to add $10 million to the city's budget. 3 weeks ago, though, City Council voted to ban the products. Do we know yet, Heather, whether the mayor will veto that ban? I tried to ask him earlier this week. Have you gotten anything out of him in the last couple of days?
We asked him about it at City Hall this week. He said he hadn't decided yet, but today is the day. So at any moment, I expect a statement from the mayor's office to pop into my inbox. However, they can text me directly and just, you know, let me know personally first if they want to. That would be fine.
You heard it here on BEZ first. To contact WTTW.
That's right. So we don't know what he's going to do. Now, if he does veto it, it would be his second veto.
Yes.
The city council would then have an attempt to override that veto. They would need 34 votes. If that vote occurs, that would be a very close vote. But the larger issue is that there is a nationwide ban on these intoxicating hemp products that's set to go into effect in November. It is not clear whether the feds will actually follow through.
Will they be pulled from
that?
Shelves anyway?
Exactly. Yeah. So there's a lot we don't know.
Now, an ordinance that passed a city council committee could soon deputize Chicagoans to help enforce parking and crosswalk violations. I don't know if you've heard of this, Hannah, but the idea here is essentially to get people to tip off parking enforcement by submitting a photo when you see, you know, folks parking in, you know, commercial vehicles parking in bus lanes, bike lanes, submit a photo of it and send it to 311.
This has been going on Twitter for years. People take, you know, pictures of these delivery vehicles.
Because you're basically snitching on your fellow Chicagoan at this point.
Well, sure. But, you know, like you said, it's commercial vehicles, which do seem to be, for the most part, the
culprits?
The culprits, yes, thank you for the
biggest offenders.
Exactly. And I think, you know, maybe the threat of an uptick in reporting and then, you know, fines and fees might motivate companies like Amazon to do more training of their local drivers who are often contracted.
Yes, good point.
I think it's interesting. I think, you know, Bike Twitter is probably maybe excited about this. Chicago Bike Twitter, very, very
active
yes. in reporting these violations.
Heather, some motorists, they might avoid getting towed. This is under a measure endorsed by the City Council's Finance Committee. What are the details?
Well, this is the resolution potentially of a long-running lawsuit filed by a woman who uses a wheelchair and had her van, which had a wheelchair lift in it, towed away because it was reported as abandoned. And the way the city currently handles that is that if you have a valid license registration sticker on your car and it's reported as abandoned, you get an extra notice in the mail. But if you do not have valid license plate registration stickers on your car, you don't get that extra thing. So what happened here is this van was towed to the city's impound lot before that her family could retrieve it. It was sold for scrap. She lost her, you know, ability to get around the city. So this agreement would pay her $25,000, cover her attorney's fees, but also change the way the city does this, that now would require the city to essentially treat all cars reported as abandoned as the same, whether they have valid license registration stickers or not, hopefully giving people another chance to, you know, sort of figure out how they can sort of make sure that they don't get their cars towed. But, you know, this is one of the, is, you know, in all, it would create sort of a fund that if this has happened to you, you could go to the city and either get the money back that you paid to get your car out of the impound lot, or if your car was sold for scrap, I should say, also slap, I guess, you would get like $1,200 in sort of reimbursement.
All right. I want to steer the conversation over to Springfield now. There are a couple of bills brewing that I just want to dive into. Hannah, let's start with that newly introduced legislation that would place tighter regulations on data centers, the places that use up massive amounts of water and electricity to help power our increasingly digital world. So what is being proposed here?
Yeah, this so-called Power Act would be a sort of comprehensive set of regulations on data centers. I want to go back to 2021, the last time that the legislature did a huge power bill. And, you know, since then, at the time, I would say that the warnings of increased, you know, power bills to individual residents, in addition to manufacturers, but really individual residents, I think were largely ignored. I think some people thought they were overblown, and that's because at some level, I don't think anyone saw the AI revolution coming that would, you know, was kind of around the corner the next year, 2022.
Right.
The end of it was really when we saw AI.
A big boom.
Huge boom in, like, people, you know, actually starting to use it in their everyday lives. And in the years following, you know, not only has it become, you know, extremely widespread, but also people's power bills have indeed been going up. Data centers, of course, just like manufacturers, use a huge amount of energy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think states, not just Illinois, but lots of states have been grappling what to do, you know, about these rising power bills. Because, again, not just a problem in Illinois. So the Power Act would do a number of things. It would make data centers report, for example, how much water they're using. Water, these data centers, especially the ones that are equipped for AI, that are, you know, hugely different
right.
than the traditional data centers that had been, you know, booming for the last 10, 15 years. They use a huge amount of water to cool down the servers in there.
Right. And electricity.
And electricity. And, you know, it would require, for example, also data centers to get permits from the Illinois EPA. And I think it's really interesting because Illinois Democrats who control the legislature, of course, the governor himself, very supportive of data centers, In the abstract, in, back in 2019, his first year in office, he signed, big legislation to offer tax credits to, you know, kind of make Illinois a data center capital of at least the Midwest, if not the country. But at the same time, you know, he and many other Democrats have constituencies tied to environmental groups who are, you know, very, very concerned about what they've been seeing over the last few years. This might, you know, in negotiation that I would expect this spring, if not, you know, it very much could boil over to
it's
fall.
It's the hot topic these days, these data centers. John, four Democratic-led states have sued to block the Trump administration from cutting off hundreds of millions of dollars in public health grants. This lawsuit was filed in Chicago. What should we know?
Well, first of all, the cuts have been blocked.
Oh,
by, as a result of this lawsuit.
Breaking news.
Very, very quick turnaround on this. Judge Manish Shah entered a temporary restraining order yesterday, finding that the plaintiffs, including the state of Illinois, are likely to succeed on their claims. So this was a lawsuit. This was another effort by the Consortium of Attorneys General that Illinois Attorney General Kwame Raoul is participating in. And the AG's office did appear to take the lead on this one. So they sued over the Trump administration's threat to withhold $600 million in public health grants. Illinois was joined by California, Colorado, and Minnesota here. And part of the claim was, part of their argument was that what these cuts are really about is punishing these states for their sanctuary jurisdiction policies, not participating in immigration enforcement. And this has been a real theme throughout the year. I mean, I think Hannah mentioned the National Guard litigation last fall. Again, that was the Attorney General's office said that that was about punishing the state for sanctuary policies. They're saying the same thing here. And Judge Shah did find that it appears that these actions by the Trump administration are based on an arbitrary, capricious, or unconstitutional rationale.
Can't do that.
To be clear, this is a 14-day temporary restraining order, so there's more to come, but, you know, temporary
blocks. These temporary blocks. All right, Heather, that is not the only funding that the Trump administration is denying Illinois. They've also rejected disaster relief. This is for last summer's flooding in Chicago. I know many of us remember that. Let's listen quickly to what Mayor Johnson had to say.
We're going to push back, obviously, and yeah, it's unfortunate that this administration has shown so much animus towards working people, but I'm going to use every single tool that's available to me to protect our people in our city, but to ensure that we receive our fair share from the federal government, particularly when these families desperately need relief as quickly as possible.
I mean, did the president explain why he refused to grant Illinois this disaster relief money?
Well, the White House put out a statement saying that it's their job to ensure that tax dollars are spent appropriately and that this request did not meet whatever standard that they believe.
So you got yourself in this mess. Figure it out.
Well, the Trump administration, by and large, has tried to shift the way disasters are responded to by the federal government by basically saying this is the state's problem and we're here to help in some circumstances. Now, what's at issue here is that, of course, Illinois was not the only state to be hit by these storms. The president approved disaster declarations in states like Alaska and Nebraska and North Dakota. And why are those states different, you may ask, than Illinois? Well, those are all states that voted for President Trump in the 2024 presidential election, whereas states like Vermont and Illinois had their disaster declarations rejected. Of course, they gave their electoral votes to the former vice president.
So it might seem politically motivated. Remember all that drama last year over the Chicago Public Schools CEO? Well, it's a new year, but the drama continues. Now the Chicago School Board is accusing Mayor Johnson of sabotaging their CEO search. Heather, fill us in.
CPS is one of several sister agencies and city departments that does not have a permanent leader. And there are some members on the school board, all of whom were elected independently and were not appointed by the mayor, who say that that's really the mayor's fault because they had conducted a search. They hired a search firm. That search firm came up with two finalists, but that it never came to fruition. And they say that that's the mayor's fault. Now, the mayor says, it's not my fault. Somebody on the board leaked those names to WBEZ and the Sun-Times, mm-hmm. and that prompted at least one of those candidates to withdraw, which sort of sent the search process back to zero. So the mayor says that it's not my fault, it's y'all's fault, so you should figure out what you're going to do there.
Oh,
the larger issue is that this is one of those problems because we're in this sort of weird limbo between a fully elected school board and a half-appointed, half-elected school board. The law sort of creating the elected school board is a little bit unclear over who exactly should appoint the superintendent, and there are several members of the school board who think that Macklin King, the interim superintendent, should just basically stay there until the fully elected school board takes office in 2027.
Goodness. All right, well, in other news, football season, it's done, it's over, but the stadium saga, that is on.
It never ends.
No, it never, never ends. There's no end in sight. We got several communities now. They're trying to make that final push to get picked. And a new one, Portage, Indiana? Even Iowa seemed to make a pitch for the Bears. What's the latest, Hannah?
So Portage, Indiana is the latest community in Northwest Indiana to pitch a Bears stadium, along with, of course, three different sites proposed in Gary and in Hammond. I'm not sure how seriously anyone's going to take this. The Indiana legislature has a bill on the docket that would constitute a financial authority that would help basically build with some state dollars a stadium wherever yeah. that might go. But the legislature adjourns in just a couple weeks. I don't know that, anything will happen out of Portage, but the larger thing is, is this putting a fire under Illinois lawmakers and Governor J.B. Pritzker?
Are you sensing, Hannah, that that state legislators and the governor are more open to doing what they can to just keep the team here in Illinois?
I do think so. I mean, we've seen several signals from that. I will say the last time I was, in a public forum talking about the Bears, I called, any plans, anything from the Bears signaling an openness to Northwest Indiana, a bluff, a kind of insulting bluff, frankly. And I still do stand by that. But the governor has said that he doesn't view anything as a bluff. The Tribune reported a couple weeks ago that the governor had met with the NFL commissioner, Roger Goodell, when he was here for that big game. I think it was against the Packers in January. And, he's also contracted with an outside law firm to kind of handle talks. So I think that there is a seriousness. I also, though, think that the Bears are bluffing because they have signaled that they would be open to things in Illinois that is locked in, not locked, but it's in proposed legislation that would include something called project labor agreements, which is a huge thing for organized labor, which of course is a huge constituency for Illinois Democrats, and also guaranteeing minority owned contracts. And those things are not present in the Indiana legislation. And I think that the Bears being pro those things,
then stay here. Exactly.
But it's been 3 years since the Bears bought the former racetrack in Arlington Heights. And, for 3 years they've been sitting on this land. They're eager to build. I think, the debate is no longer whether it's Arlington Heights or Chicago. I think it is Arlington Heights. And it's just
and
gonna
just how
get,
soon.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. In other news, Heather, Alders and city lawyers, they've been grappling with several police misconduct settlements this week. Break it down. What's happening?
Well, the big ones would compensate four men who spent a combined 71 years in prison after they were wrongfully convicted based on evidence collected by former police detective Reynaldo Guevara, who has been accused of routinely framing suspects for a series of murders when he was in charge of most murderers investigations in the Humboldt Park area back in the 1990s. days. Mm-hmm. And these are all men who have had their convictions overturned. Several of them have certificates of innocence. And this is sort of the latest chapter in this sort of ongoing effort to resolve these cases. This is not the end of it. There is another man suing the city whose ongoing federal trial is happening right now. So it will be up to the jury in that case to decide whether he deserves any compensation for spending 17 years in prison. Beyond that, there are 37 other lawsuits pending that name former Detective Guevara. And so far,
we're expecting more payouts.
Correct. So far, the city has already paid $112 million to compensate 9 people wrongfully convicted. This would bring the number of lawsuits to a total of $141 million. And the city has spent a significant amount of money defending Guevara and the other officers named in these lawsuits. The lawsuit's up for a vote on Wednesday. The city has already paid $5.2 million to defend. Mm-hmm. So the costs of these lawsuits is really hard to overstate and very significant in a city that is facing deficits as far as the eye can see.
Incredible. John, I want to get an update from you. This is on a separate but very important issue as well. The Chicago man accused and recently cleared in that Bovino murder plot. Mm-hmm. Where is he now?
ICE custody. He's still in federal custody. Oh. So, yeah, you're right. This has been an important one for us to watch. This is the man who went on trial in January. There was a lot made. You know, Homeland Security has claimed that there have been bounties placed on the heads of people like Greg Bovino by drug cartels and street gangs. This was one case that they charged, went to trial, and a jury found Juan Espinoza Martinez not guilty. He's been in custody since October on those charges, and the day after his acquittal, he was taken into ICE custody. And this week, an immigration judge who was appointed last fall by Attorney General Pam Bondi ruled that he, I believe, posed a potential danger, as based on reported by my colleague Cindy Hernandez, mm-hmm. who covered the hearing, and I was there for part of it as well. And I think what's notable here is that part of the presentation by Homeland Security was about the very same evidence that the jury rejected. And in fact, they used some of the evidence that had been barred from his trial to argue that he should continue to be held in custody. So I believe there's a removal hearing set for later this month. His attorneys are still fighting all of this, but despite his acquittal, he's still in federal custody.
Oh, boy. Hannah, Tuesday, a federal judge upheld a first-of-its-kind Illinois law. This is protecting consumers and retailers from credit card swipe fees on taxes and tips. What are the details of the law?
So the law is, like you said, a first-of-its-kind anywhere in the entire world that would prevent these credit card swipe fees, which are about 2% of every transaction from a credit card, from being charged on taxes and tips. Now, the bankers, the credit unions, which are often at odds, they're together in this lawsuit, and small businesses and a bunch of other groups, they say that this is, in a kind of insane law that has not been tested anywhere else. And the judge had put the law on hold, and then the legislature in response had delayed the implementation of the law till July. And kind of in a surprising reversal of her initial ruling, the judge actually upheld the law this week. The opponents say that the fight's not over and that it's going to be appealed. But, I think what's interesting here is the it is being sold as a consumer protection law, but really consumers are not going to notice this. And so it does benefit big retailers especially, and that's why small businesses are actually not on the side of it. And the banks, they say that if you follow this law to its logical end, that you could eventually be forced to pay taxes and tips in cash.
Oh, okay.
It's very interesting, very, in the weeds.
Well, I want to hear from all of you on this. Drone delivery of Amazon packages. It's soon going to be a thing for residents in the South Chicago suburbs. Now, Amazon will begin offering its Prime Air service this summer near fulfillment centers in Markham and Madison. Crane Chicago Business reports customers within 7.5 miles of those facilities, they're going to be able to get certain packages delivered by drone within 2 hours. An Amazon rep says the delivery drones can carry packages that weigh up to 5 pounds, and they have dimensions of a, quote, pretty large shoebox.
Oh, okay.
How do you feel about this? I happened to see video, I think it was somewhere on social media, of a couple somewhere else in the country getting groceries delivered by drone, and watching the process of the drone like coming all the way down, very slowly, mind you, very, very slowly. And as it got closer, I was like, what on earth can fit in there? And surprisingly, it was two grocery bags worth of, you know, worth of produce. But would you do this?
We need to welcome our new drone overlords and, you know, figure out what sort of tribute they want so they don't murder us all in our sleep. But I mean, it's like, you know, I certainly abuse the Prime delivery. I have kids. I can't get to the store for everything that they need on any given day.
Yeah.
But it just, you know, I don't know that this is something that like we need, and again, the amount of energy, and
it was so pointless. Yeah. To watch it, I was cringing. Like, really, you're just gonna stand there and watch this drone just like slowly like, I mean for folks who need it, sure, obviously. Yeah. But you know, I think of these drones, the delivery robots on the sidewalks. I mean, you, folks are not happy about them.
Well,
either
I mean, the Amazon drones, I feel like we were first told about this, shown videos of what it could look like 10 years ago,
right.
And people didn't like it then. And I don't think that enough time has passed that people are willing to accept this.
Yeah.
The robot delivery, I don't know, how do you even describe them? Carts?
I don't know what they are.
Vehicles on the streets that you see sometimes on the sidewalk. They've been, especially during the winter when they've tried to maneuver the snow, it's been particularly funny. But like, I don't think that people like those either.
Yeah, they're not a fan favorite. Alderman LaSpada took a survey of his residents. 83% of them don't like it. Anyway, that's all the time we have.
Life is weird.
My thanks to Hannah Meisel, Heather Sharon, and John Seidel. Thank you all. Have a good weekend.
You too.
Thanks.
Thank you.
This episode of the In the Loop podcast was produced by me, Andrea Guffman, and edited by Ethan Schwab. Sasha Ann Simons is our host. For more in-depth coverage of news and culture in Chicago, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For a full archive of the show, head over to wbez.org/InTheLoop. Thanks for listening.